loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host, John Kiriakou. In the wake of the horrible terror attacks in New York, we are joined from New York for the full hour to discuss this, what it means, what comes next. We're joined from New York by Ben Norton. He is a journalist for Alternet's Gray Zone Project. You can find his writings on bennorton.com. We're joined from California by Cindy Sheehan. She is an anti-war activist and journalist. And we are joined from New York by Danny Shaw. He is a professor and an activist. Welcome, Cindy, Danny, and Ben Norton.
Thank you, Brian.
In this hour, we're going to take a look at the terrorist attack that took place in New York City. We want to take a look at why these attacks are happening, not just in New York, but other countries, the rise of so-called jihadi terrorism. We want to put it into the big picture of U.S. foreign policy of the last 30 years. 30 years ago, this phenomena did not exist. We also want to talk about Donald Trump's reaction to the terrorist attack yesterday in New York and say, compare it to how Donald Trump reacted to the mass shooting in Las Vegas just about a month ago. Cindy Sheehan, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I see, you know, this morning I was looking at all the news and I was looking at so-called news, and I was looking at alternative news, etc. And the thing that strikes me about this is, first, he was an Islamic terrorist, and they found out he was from Uzbekistan, and so it was he might not have been a terrorist, but then it was a terrorist act, and then all of a sudden they find a note from him also. So they are saying that this Saipov was a terrorist. And another thing that strikes me is when Paddock killed 58, almost five dozen people in Las Vegas, it was termed he was disturbed because, you know, he was a white American male. And almost immediately, Saipov was being called a terrorist, and he killed eight people, which is tragic. And the thing is, why is it happening now and it didn't really happen 30 years ago? Well, after the events on 9/11, the U.S. set out on its own program of terror around the world. And so I think, like, and all the things that are happening in London, that, you know, Great Britain has been a very energetic member of the Coalition of the Willing, the so-called Coalition of the Willing, partnered with the U.S. and its crimes of humanity around the world, that nobody stops and takes a breath and tries to figure out or investigate what happens before a lot of pronouncements are made. And, you know, I think that has been you know, a major travesty of so-called journalism, is that nobody really knows what's happening. So they start to talk about it and they start to make pronouncements. And even if those are proven wrong, people who watch the initial coverage of it, they still, you know, continue to believe that all of these things are true. So, of course, we are, you know, we have sympathy for the families of the people who are killed and for the people who are wounded. But I really think we should stop a minute and try to figure out what's happening before we start to, you know, make judgments and these pronouncements that may or may not turn out to be actual facts.
Yeah, the facts are important. That was the voice of Cindy Sheehan, anti-war activist, journalist. She has her own show, Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Cindy's son, Casey, was killed during the Iraq War. And after that, and during that entire period, she was a major figure in the U.S. anti-war movement. John Kiriakou, before we turn to Ben Norton, I want to ask you again about the reactions, the very different reactions from the Trump administration about these two latest killings. You had the big killing, so many people, almost 60 people dead, hundreds wounded in Las Vegas. The question came up then, why do these things happen? And Donald Trump and the Trump administration said, this is not the time to talk about that.
Right.
And of course, there's mass shootings in the United States every day. a mass shooting defined as shooting more than four or more people at one time. But here we have a person from Uzbekistan who's the suspect. And immediately Donald Trump not only says the diversity visa program is the result, he's now ending the program. He's right. Now taking measures to end the program. I mean, why the difference in the response?
First of all, I think Cindy makes a very important point here, and that is that mental illness and terrorism are not mutually exclusive. You can be mentally ill and carry out a terrorist attack. And what we saw in Las Vegas, to me, is very clearly a terrorist attack. If the point is to instill terror in the populace, that's a terrorist attack. But we didn't hear Donald Trump say then that guns should be taken away from white men or even from mentally ill people. He said it was not terrorism, it was a crime. But what happened in New York is terrorism. Don't get me wrong, terrorism is real. Terrorism is something that we should be concerned about. But dividing it, categorizing it, separating it from things that are done by white men with legally purchased guns is going to get us nowhere. I, too, am interested in this visa diversity program. There's no indication whatsoever that it's not working. It actually is working. Last year, the visa diversity program admitted most of the people who came into the United States on the visa diversity program came from Nepal and from Egypt, right? You go to New York and there's a large and vibrant Egyptian community. There's no terrorism coming from Nepal. There's no reason to end the program because you're afraid of Nepalis somehow taking to the streets and killing people. And also the program was created in the 1980s in part by Senator Ted Kennedy to allow Irish immigrants to come into the country because they had been largely blocked by the Immigration Reform Act of 1965, which favored reunification of families of skilled workers, and Kennedy believed discriminated against the Irish. This is a program that has actually worked over the years. It's a program that has allowed us to create these very vibrant immigrant communities, not just in the big cities like New York and Los Angeles, but all around the country. And we have a huge Kurdish population in Fargo, North Dakota, and a Kurdish population in St. Louis, Missouri. This makes us a better country, a stronger country. But I'd like to ask Ben Norton what he thinks ought to be done if there should be reforms. You know, certainly reform could be a good thing in just about any federal program we look at. How do we make this better and at the same time keep the country safe?
When you look at most of these cases, it's involving, excluding this case, typically native-born people. And this is true not just of the U.S., this is true for attacks in Europe. We're frequently talking about attacks that have been carried out by people who were radicalized internally, and they were frequently citizens or at least naturalized. In this case, the attacker had a green card, but there are very few cases of new migrants carrying out attacks like this. It's frequently people who have been in the country for years, if not their entire lives. So I think even having that discussion, in this case, perhaps it's a bit more relevant, but in general, when you look at the variety of attacks that have been carried out, these are radicalized individuals who are frequently claiming to be part of a larger international group. So I think we have to look at two different factors. One, why these individuals are claiming to be part of these parts of these groups. Frequently, they actually don't really have any tangible links. You know, they just say that they declared loyalty to ISIS. And of course, ISIS has it in its political interest to take credit for attacks to make it appear more powerful and dangerous. So for instance, ISIS, through its media propaganda networks, claimed credit for the Las Vegas attack, which clearly had nothing to do with ISIS. So we have to be able to decouple those things. But then I think we also need to ask ourselves why, as Brian alluded to in the beginning of the show, this is a problem today. Because, you know, as he mentioned, 30 years ago, people were not carrying out these kinds of isolated jihadi attacks. This is a political problem. It's not a problem about migration. It's not a problem about even assimilation necessarily. It's a political problem. People are being radicalized in a particular political direction. And it's not just Salafi jihadists. It's also white supremacists and neo-Nazis. you know, it bears stressing. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's very important to keep in mind in the context of all of this that the vast majority of terror attacks carried out in the U.S. are carried out by white supremacists and far-right extremists. And Islamist extremists are a similar part of that problem. You know, why are these radicalized individuals claiming fidelity and loyalty to these particular political movements? It's because these political movements have traction, they're growing, and they're being fed by different forces throughout the world. And ISIS, I mean, of course, we can get to later in this program, is a direct product of U.S. foreign policy, of the wars in the Middle East, of the spread of Wahhabi extremist Islam from Saudi Arabia and Gulf states for decades, just as for decades, white supremacists in the U.S. have been organizing and coalescing and you know, radicalizing people and spreading propaganda. So I think, like you said, I mean, we can have a discussion about, you know, visa programs, et cetera, immigration, but I think that, frankly, that is not the most relevant discussion. I mean, in this case, again, it's somewhat exceptional, but in the vast majority of these cases in France and elsewhere, we're dealing with people who have been here for years. And even in this case, he's been here for 7 years. So we need to look beyond that, look at the politics.
Yeah, that's Ben Norton. You can read his writings at bennorton.com. Professor Danny Shaw, we just heard that Donald Trump has said that he's willing to consider sending the suspect, Saifullo Saibov, who's from Uzbekistan, who is not, quote, radicalized in Uzbekistan. He's become radicalized since he came to the United States, sending him to Guantanamo. So here we have a situation, as we have almost with every terrorist attack, starting with September 11th, that the terrorist attack becomes a pretext for the political administration to do what it wants to do. In the case of George W. Bush, they wanted to go to war in Iraq. So even though Iraq didn't have anything to do with 9/11, Saddam Hussein was not with al-Qaeda. He was not a supporter of Osama bin Laden. They went ahead and invaded Iraq. And now we have Trump, who said that Obama was wrong for wanting to close Guantanamo, using this incident again, not only to shut down the diversity visa program, but maybe to sort of start Guantanamo humming again. Go ahead.
First and foremost, our thoughts go out to everyone who lost the 8 people who lost their lives yesterday. Really a terrible tragedy. I teach at a university not far from where it happened, at John Jay College. And 5 Argentinians lost their lives. They were celebrating their high school reunion here in New York City. So our thoughts go out to the people of Argentina as well. And it's sad that it takes these horrific incidents to realize the terrorism that's happening. But of course, we need to look deeper into the context of what's created this terrorism, as Ben was saying, and Brian as well. And this is a product of U.S. foreign policy. Both Tillerson and Mattis on Monday, we're advocating for the continuation of this global program where the U.S. can go anywhere and accuse anyone of being a terrorist and intervene. And certainly hearing again that Guantanamo, the base at Guantanamo, Cuba, is going to be used to imprison these terrorists, it just shows the U.S. Arrogance. And if you go back to what the Tsarnaev brothers said, the perpetrators of the horrific attack at the Boston Marathon, the Kryzak Americans, they said they were radicalized not by ISIS, but by U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. war against the people of Iraq and Afghanistan. So as long as there continues to be genocide and invasion, recolonization of Libya, of Syria, of Iraq, of Afghanistan, of Palestine, we should almost expect this colonial boomerang of violence to swing back, the pendulum to swing back. And it's innocent people that are being killed here in the U.S. We saw the attacks in Germany and Nice, France. And it's important to point out, as Brian did, that these suicide bombings and these truck attacks is a relatively new phenomenon. You didn't see this 30, 40 years ago. Uzbekistan was part of the Soviet Union, as was Kyrgyzstan. So it's important to see this all in a historical context.
Cindy Sheehan, I know you have to leave soon, but let's pick up where Danny took us right there. U.S. foreign policy looks like perhaps and what ISIS will describe it as a war against Islam. Whether it's a war against Islam or directed for anti-Islamic motives, it is the United States at war in all of these Islamic countries. You can see why that ISIS narrative might ring true to some alienated or deranged or unstable people, or people who are just really, really, really angry. Go ahead.
Well, and it's also interesting that the Islamic State and other groups who are currently fighting against the state of Syria and in Iraq and Kurdistan, that a lot of proof has been shown that they are funded and trained by the United States to further its own agenda in the Middle East. And I just want to say, before I have to go, I was also thinking of the Sarnoff brothers in Boston, and many, you know, Howard Zinn said that war is just terrorism with a bigger budget. And, you know, many of these so-called radicalized terrorists, you know, homegrown or wherever, especially in the United States, many of them have been recruited and brought along by the FBI. And we see in many of the failed terrorist plots, there was one just recently in Florida, is that these people were egged on by the FBI. So this is entrapment. And then they're, you know, finally given bombs that don't work. And, you know, things like that. So, you know, obviously, if the U.S. didn't have such a radical foreign policy that targets a certain and now with the Trump administration, it's been really, you know, really like transferred also to radical domestic policy. And, you know, we're in a very dangerous time where it's very dangerous around the world to be associated as an Arab or Islam. So we just really need to, like I said in my answer earlier, is we need to take a breath and really analyze this situation and, you know, not rush to all kinds of misinformed judgment about these things. And it always goes back to U.S. foreign policy and how that is rightfully upsetting people here and around the world. So I guess that's all I have to say before I have to take off now.
Thank you so much, Cindy, for joining us. We'll be back to you soon.
Brian, I know we have less than a minute before we have to take a break, but I would like to reiterate something that you have said on this program a couple of times. There has been a recent worldwide Gallup poll, which found that something like 74-75% of countries, when respondents are asked which country is the greatest threat to world peace, 74-75% of those countries or the citizens of those countries have responded that it's the United States. And I think that as a nation, we need to take that very seriously. This is how the rest of the world sees us. And we have to ask ourselves, why do we need to be involved militarily or even otherwise in places like Libya or Somalia or Yemen or a dozen or two dozen other countries around the world? If we have nothing productive to offer, if we can't help people non-militarily, why are we there in the first place? This is just going to put us farther down that rabbit hole.
Agree with you. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker with John Kiriakou. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're talking for the full hour between 4 and 5 today about the horrible terrorist attack in New York City yesterday. We are joined from New York by Ben Norton. He is a journalist for Alternet's Gray Zone Project, and you can find his writings on bennorton.com. We are joined from California in our first segment by Cindy Sheehan. And we are joined also from New York by Danny Shaw. He is a professor and political activist. Ben Norton, you know, I was just thinking earlier today The United States hasn't just started acting as an imperialist power and going to war in the last 30 years, even though we're using the 30-year time framework, comparing where we are now in 2017 to 1987, where jihadi terrorist attacks were not taking place all over Europe and in the United States and, of course, in the Middle East. But there were earlier wars, and there was, of course, the war in Vietnam, for instance. Millions of Vietnamese people died. There was the war in Korea. Millions of Koreans died. Tens of thousands of Americans died in each of those wars. And yet the Vietnamese, when they were fighting the United States, they were trying to win over the people of the United States. They were always making the distinction between the American people and the American government. They said, we don't hate the American people. They are our sisters and brothers. They should join us as part of an anti-war movement. It's the government that speaks in their name that has an imperial foreign policy. That's our problem. Today, there's no such appeal. These forces who are fighting against imperial powers are working within the framework of a clash of civilizations. In other words, the American people are part and parcel of the enemy, and so they're good targets. In other words, they don't consider them just cowardly acts against soft targets. It's all one and the same. In other words, it appears to the jihadi forces that this is a religious war. And of course, in some ways you can understand it, as we've said, because the war is going on in all of these Muslim countries. But Ben Norton, what drives U.S. foreign policy? I mean, why did the United States go into war after war after war? Why did it block with these same ideological forces, say, in Afghanistan or in Pakistan or with Saudi Arabia? Anyway, go ahead. It's a big topic, but I want to chop away at that a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. But I think, first of all, you raised a very important point, and that is the political distinction between the movements that we see now and the movements we saw during the Cold War. During the Cold War, I mean, first of all, let me clarify by saying Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not resistance movements. They're not resisting anyone. They're interested in their own preservation of their own power. They're trying to create their own extremely reactionary Islamist regimes where they repress, you know, their own people. They're not a form of resistance. So I'm not trying to conflate them. But the point I'm trying to make is that during the Cold War, movements in the global South that were resisting foreign intervention, militarism and imperialism were largely socialist in orientation. They were anti-imperialist. They were progressive. And they were resisting foreign domination of their lands, of their natural resources, of their peoples. That has been totally crushed. It was crushed throughout the entirety of the Cold War, as you mentioned, in a variety of incredibly bloody wars through counterinsurgency programs. You can go on the list. And what we have today is there are very few resistance forces remaining. You know, you could talk about some Palestinian resistance forces and others, but what we're left with is these radicalized groups that have been largely a product of U.S. foreign policy that have become, you know, essentially blowback. So dealing with the issue of Salafi jihadists, of these extremist Islamists who not only, you know, kill people in the West, but it's important to remember the majority of their victims are actually fellow Muslims in the Middle East and South Asia, especially Muslims of different sects. So Shia Muslims and other minority Muslim groups. These groups have their origins in the Cold War on the opposite side. In the 1980s, of course, the most infamous example is the United States in partnership with its allies, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, supported extremist groups inside Afghanistan to fight the Soviet Union, which were known as the Mujahideen. The Mujahideen are really, in some ways, the kind of ideological and political forefathers for many of the groups we see today. So the Taliban and Al-Qaeda directly have their origins in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And at that moment, they were supported by the CIA in order to fight the socialist government of Afghanistan backed by the Soviet Union. And you can look throughout the world. What groups, as you mentioned, are the ones that do not distinguish civilians from governments? It's not revolutionary socialist and leftist groups. It's the opposite. It's the far right groups. It's fascist groups. So you mentioned the year 1987. Well, it's true that there weren't really Islamist attacks on civilians. But if we go to Nicaragua, for instance, we see the CIA supporting the Contras, which were carrying out very similar attacks, mass murdering civilians, you know, killing husbands in front of their wives and brutally dismembering them. And these kinds of very similar tactics that we fast forward today and see in Syria and Iraq. This kind of violence is really, at the end of the day, rooted in empire. And because resistance movements have been so thoroughly crushed throughout the Middle East and much of the world, all that's left that has festered for these past 30 years have been these extremist groups that have turned on their former imperial sponsors. And of course, that relationship is contradictory and it goes back and forth. In some countries, even though the U.S. is waging a so-called war on terror and has for 16 years now, the U.S. is allied with al-Qaeda. So in Yemen and Syria, you know, the U.S. may claim that it's opposed to al-Qaeda and maybe launch an airstrike or two sometimes, but U.S. policy for years has effectively empowered al-Qaeda in Yemen, Libya, and Syria. And then in Afghanistan, of course, the U.S. is fighting the Taliban. In Iraq, it's been fighting ISIS. So we see these very contradictory policies. But at the end of the day, we can't talk about the problem of Islamist extremism and these extremist groups that are attacking civilians without understanding the much larger political context that, you know, as you acknowledged, goes back decades to the early parts of the Cold War, not just the past 30 years.
That was so on point and so important that a recording of what Ben Norton just said should be circulated to every public school in America, honest to God.
Oh, man.
No, I'm serious, because nothing's going to change unless we start to acknowledge that we have these problems in this country. And we address the fact that our foreign policy leads to a lot of the attacks that we see, where we end up wringing our hands and bemoaning the fact that we were targets and then wondering aloud, why does this always happen to us? Well, there's actually an answer to that question, why this always happens to us. And it's with our foreign policy. I'd like to ask Danny Shaw, on a domestic level, what can we do? Or let me rephrase it even. Is there anything that we can do to stop these lone wolf attacks? I think New York probably has been very fortunate in that it's got a police department that works hand in glove with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. It's a very diverse police department. By all accounts, it has good community relations and immigrant communities in the city. And frankly, I think on top of all that, we've been very lucky. But what is it that other police departments or other localities in the country can do to either disrupt an attack like we saw in New York yesterday or forestall one?
Well, it's a very difficult question to address when you have these lone wolf individuals who are using vehicles now as weapons. And the question of more police and more security, we have the New York City Marathon coming up on Sunday. It's also a very divisive question. It really polarizes New York City, because while many will say, yes, you know, more police and more checks, of course, the black and brown communities of the Bronx and Harlem and Brooklyn and beyond have felt that the number one terrorist in New York City, and this isn't hyperbole, is the NYPD.
Right.
And since Amadou Diallo was killed in 2000, there's been some 120 some odd people murdered by the NYPD. And when have we ever seen an officer go to jail for those crimes against the people? So there's an incredible double standard here when it comes to what we define as terrorism. And the study that John referred to, that 74% of the world sees the U.S. as the greatest purveyor of violence, is consistent with reality, with what U.S. foreign policy has done to all these countries that we mentioned, Yemen, Libya, Syria. And of course, always in the name of freedom and democracy, they supported the Mujahideen, the precursor to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and they supported the quote-unquote National Transitional Council in Libya and the Syrian Democratic Forces, which were often nothing more than fig leaves or camouflages for ISIS and other extremist forces. So the chickens are coming home to roost. The U.S. thinks they can trot across the globe and swagger across in this arrogant way. And it has created an anti-imperialist and an anti-American sentiment. And we're seeing that play out in the streets of New York. So I think one of the best things that we could do to keep Americans safe is stop invading these other countries. And the mainstream media brings up North Korea and there's no solution and this is so difficult. There's a very simple solution. Leave North Korea alone. Who have they ever hurt? Who are they a threat to? Who could ever take that serious that they're a threat to anybody? And the same goes for what happened in Iraq and in Syria. And what the U.S. did in Syria was they kept ISIS on a short leash. There were times that they, quote-unquote, attacked ISIS, but many times with the Saudis and with the Turkish forces, they used ISIS as a proxy power to do their work, their dirty work, because ultimately the goal was to overthrow any regime that is not in the U.S.'s pocket, is not a puppet to the U.S. So Bashar al-Assad and Kim Jong-un and Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, their true crimes had nothing to do with human rights in the eyes of the U.S. foreign policy establishment. Their true crimes were that they did not genuflect before the altar of U.S. imperialism.
Well, John, you know, when you think about the American policy, and we've talked about the contradictoriness, it's both ad hoc and contradictory, you know, bordering on schizophrenic, if you to take it literally. You had 15 of the 19 hijackers in September 11th came from Saudi Arabia. That's right. That's what the National Commission said. We know the Saudi government has fostered and supported Al-Qaeda. They were big supporters of Taliban in Afghanistan. Very big, as you know.
Yes.
And at the same time, the United States government gave the Saudi, during the Obama administration, $110 billion in arms sales. And in the first visit, foreign country visit by Donald Trump was to Saudi Arabia, and he offered them another $110 billion. Certainly, the Saudis have their own agenda. They're not simply puppets of the United States. They have an agenda.
The Saudis are a malevolent force in the Middle East.
Yeah. And they've gone to war in Libya, you know, supporting terrorist jihadi groups, same in Syria.
They financed the Syria war.
Yeah, financed it. And as we know from the Intercept from last week, some of the dramatic missile attacks, artillery attacks on downtown Damascus were ordered by a Saudi prince. It was commemorating the second anniversary of the so-called Syrian Revolution. But here you have in the United States, there's a cynicism about this because, and this comes to the question of safety and security. The FBI keeps setting up these phony terrorist attacks, busting these hapless creatures who are been engaged by them. And then they have press conferences and kind of like, we saved the country, we protected the country. We keep carrying out a foreign policy that's very closely aligned with Saudi Arabia. And then, in spite of all the money that's spent on security, there really hasn't been any stopping of the so-called lone terrorist attacks. I mean,
no, and there have been opportunities. I mean, look at the Southern California attack from a couple of years ago. The perpetrators of that attack were communicating openly over Xbox or one of these game systems. We're not talking about encrypted secret communications here. Despite the fact that the FBI spent $1.6 million to try to crack open the guy's iPhone, most of the communications were over a game system. While at the same time, the FBI is, as you rightly point out, Brian, setting up idiots who walk into their traps in places like Cleveland and Seattle and Portland. You know, when I was arrested, my wife said something. It was just an offhanded comment, but it really stuck with me because it's so true. She said, you know, as awful as this experience is, this is the experience of being arrested and awaiting trial. She said, what bothers me the most is some FBI idiot is going to get promoted over this. And we see the same thing today. Somebody's going to get promoted over this. And not just this, but these fake arrests, these entrapment arrests that the FBI makes all around the country, that's how they get promoted.
Yeah.
And this isn't new. You know, we saw this when J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI. But,
and, you know, and it makes me think, you know, Danny Shaw used the expression, the chickens coming home to roost, but maybe it doesn't matter. In other words, maybe the U.S. government really doesn't care that much because, in fact, every terrorist attack incentivizes more money for, quote, security.
Yes.
It gives a pretext for shutting down civil rights. Now it's a pretext for Trump to shut down immigration. And none of these attacks are really that dangerous from the point of view of the position of the U.S. government. It's not like a revolution is about to come.
That's right.
I mean, in other words, these are minor pinpricks for the government. Of course, terrible for the actual human beings who are harmed. Let's go back to Ben Norton. Ben, it seems to me that we're on a trajectory that's not going to be shifted without really profound radical intervention from people who can sort of break free from the dominant narrative here? Because obviously terrorist attacks are going to continue to happen, just as mass shootings are going to continue to happen, just as U.S. is going to continue to carry out targeted assassinations of people in many, many countries. President Obama's last week was drone attacks in 7 different countries. We're on a path where this becomes sort of a cycle of violence and a self-fulfilling prophecy, and one that's not actually harmful to U.S. imperial designs. In fact, maybe useful.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to address here, and I'll just address a few quick points before getting into more detail on that issue. First, I think we need to have some context for this. Like, it's very important, of course, to respect, you know, those whose families lost loved ones in this attack. And it's very important, you know, to speak about issues like this. I mean, this is a very horrific incident, and of course, we should have attention to it, but it's greatly exaggerated. Last year alone, in 2016, there were about 1,000 shootings in New York City. And, you know, about 1,000 people were shot in, like, were actually wounded or killed in those shootings. Of course, there's much less attention to that because it's not as politicized, even though I think we really should understand shootings in a much more politicized way. You don't have the same mass incidents of shootings in other countries as you do in the U.S. So it's important to look in the larger context that, yes, this is a horrific incident, but this is a very violent country, and the attention that we focus on this particular incident makes it very easy to manipulate people's emotions and get them to support things like more aggressive military intervention abroad. And beyond that, we also need to understand the context of the violence that's going on right now as we speak. This morning in North Yemen, in the province of Sa'da, the U.S.-backed Saudi coalition massacred 29 civilians and wounded 28 more, bombing a market in the north of Yemen. Again, we have no attention to this while we have constant 24/7 coverage of the attack here in New York, which killed many fewer people. So we need to understand those priorities as well. Again, it's very important to honor and respect those who have lost loved ones in this horrific incident, but we have to respect all lives equally. And why are we mourning people infinitely more here and not the people who are killed by our foreign policy abroad? And then another issue that's really important to highlight, and this is something that I wanted to address earlier, and I kind of hinted at it, but Danny also hinted at it, and that's, why are these attacks happening when they didn't happen 30 years ago in the context of the Middle East and Islamism? Because as I mentioned, you know, during the Cold War, if you want to use the argument of the chickens coming home to roost, we had revolutionary socialist movements that were resisting imperialism. And you could say, of course, the Vietnamese National Liberation Front, etc. This is an example of the chickens coming home to roost in terms of empire. They, of course, weren't targeting civilians. So I think in that sense, actually, the chickens coming home to roost argument makes much more sense. In the context of Islamist extremism, I actually think we should push back against that a little bit, because these people aren't, as I said, they're not resisting anyone. They're not resisting the U.S. empire by attacking American civilians. It's the opposite.
Ben, keep that thought, and we're going to start back after a short break with that thought. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're talking with Ben Norton and Professor Danny Shaw. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're talking about the terrorist attack in New York City yesterday, what it means, what its implications are for security, for U.S. foreign policy, for immigration. We're joined from New York by Ben Norton. He is a journalist for Alternet's Gray Zone Project. You can find his writings at bennorton.com. Earlier, we were joined from California by Cindy Sheehan. She is an anti-war activist and journalist. And we were joined by Professor Danny Shaw. Danny had to leave us because he's teaching. He's a professor. Ben Norton, before we went to break, we had to abruptly cut you off. But why don't you start up where you were, if you would?
Of course. The thing about we need to understand about a lot of these extremist Islamist groups is I don't actually buy the argument that they're resisting any kind of foreign imperial power. I think they're actually doing the opposite. They're helping reaffirm it. And this is a product of what I alluded to earlier, and that's the complete destruction of progressive resistance groups throughout not just the Middle East, but much of the world. So we're in a stage right now historically where, unfortunately, there are far-right forces that have tried to appropriate resistance movements. We even see this here in the U.S., where we see some people on the so-called alt-right, which is, you know, this white supremacist far-right movement, who claim to be anti-war. And they actually, in some cases, actually are anti-war. And we see a similar approach that's going on in parts of the Middle East, where people are mobilizing, extremist groups are exploiting these attacks that are carried out and using it to justify the growth of their far-right movements, which are fascistic, frankly. And they're just like the fascistic movements here and in Latin America with the Contras and others. And this is, of course, rooted in, again, the ideology of Wahhabism. In Yemen, for instance, I mentioned the massacre that was just carried out by the U.S.-Saudi coalition. We don't see people in Yemen who are killing and attacking American civilians. That's because there are different political movements that, when people are politicized by these horrific incidents, they're not joining Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Although, you know, there are some people doing that, but they're joining other forms of resistance movements like the Houthi movement and others. So it's important to understand the politics of the situation. And when people are in these desperate situations, they are politicized and radicalized and move in different political directions. When socialism and anti-imperialism guiding international socialist movements were the kind of dominant tendency throughout much of the global South, people who were politicized by these horrific attacks became socialists, they became communists, they became revolutionaries. Because those have been totally destroyed, all we're left with is this extremist form of Islamism that has been spread by Saudi Arabia with the backing of the United States. And so we see groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We see these, you know, extremist groups that are attacking their own neighbors. They're enslaving and killing Shia, Yazidis, Druze. And so it's not a form of resistance. It's actually, I think it's a product of imperialism. And until, like you mentioned, and this is the final point that I wanted to hit at, because you hit it in the nail on the head, until we have progressive anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist movements that are rooted in internationalism, rooted in, you know, multiculturalism and acceptance of different cultural values and norms, until those movements are created and those movements are leading the resistance, I think we're going to continue seeing the rise of these far-right forces, which fuel each other. So we have far-right forces in the Middle East, which attack civilians here, which in turn empowers the far-right in Europe and the U.S., and they take a more militaristic approach and kill civilians in the Middle East, which continues empowering the far-right forces there. There's this cycle of violence which can only be broken out with a progressive internationalist movement.
Yeah, it's a very interesting subject and a very important subject, because we know following World War II, there was the rise of radicalism in the Middle East and in Asia and all over the world. It was the post-colonial era. And the anti-colonial movements gravitated towards, in the Middle East, either pan-Arabism, which was a kind of progressive nationalism that was socialism or Baathism or communism. If you look at the case of the Iraq Revolution, for instance, in 1958, General Qasim took power, but the strongest party there was the Communist Party of Iraq.
That's right.
And they had a very strong Kurdish base. They were Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds.
And in fact, played a role in government until
63.
That's right.
Until 1963. You had in the Syria, very leftist movement. The Syrian Baathist movement and the Syrian Communist movement were very left-wing, very socialistic.
Not religious at all.
Not religious at all, affiliated with the Soviet Union.
In fact, the founder of the Ba'ath Party, Michel Aflaq, was a Christian.
Right. And in the case of the Palestinians, there was, of course, Yasser Arafat, but then there was also George Habash from the PFLB, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, also a Christian.
Also a Christian, Greek Orthodox.
And Marxist. In the case of Egypt, Nasser suppressed the Communist Party in Egypt, but tilted towards a sort of a pan-Arabism, tried to unite Egypt with Syria in the late 1950s. And that movement, as Ben Norton has said, has been largely extinguished. And if you look at who the United States is attacking, it was attacking the remnants of the Iraqi Revolution, very perverted, I would say, the
sure.
Saddam
sure.
remnant. The case of the the Assad family in Syria, Gaddafi in Libya. In other words, not the Gulf monarchies, not the religious forces.
The religious reactionaries.
They went the secular sort of leftover regimes from the anti-colonial project.
That's right. I think Ben's got a very important point here, and it's something that most Americans don't understand. And that is that U.S. foreign policy is far more anti-resistance than it is anything else, especially in the Middle East. It's as though our colonialism or our colonial mindset so clouds our judgment in foreign policy that we just can't react properly. And so where we should be fighting fascism, whether it's religious or not, we're not. We're aligning ourselves with fascist and religious fascist movements in the area, in the Middle East, and ignoring those countries that really politically ought to be our natural allies.
Yeah, and let's go back to Afghanistan, since this is a big part of this big story. Again, 1987, or even earlier in 1977, four decades ago, we had Afghanistan was a secular country. Afghanistan had a revolution in 1978. The pro-communist forces took power. They tried to create they said it's a socialist government, socialist country, but it was really just basic parts of bourgeois democracy. I mean, the right of women to vote, the right of girls to go to school. It was a basic land reform, the introduction of a minimum wage, the right to have trade unions. Afghanistan was so backward in so many parts of the country that the movement that took power in 1978 had a very limited reform program. But they were aligned with the Soviet Union. And so you had, as we all remember, the CIA supported Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen that Ben Norton talked about. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was then the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, when he talked about Afghanistan and the rise of the Mujahideen, again, financed partly by Osama bin Laden, Ben Norton, there's that famous quote. He said, like, so what? We have some radical Muslims who were supporting that small potatoes compared to undermining the Soviet Union and providing the Soviet Union with its own version of our Vietnam, meaning getting bogged down in a foreign country. In other words, the height of cynicism, and clearly willing to use these same forces who then ultimately, again, the genie came out of the bottle. They couldn't really be completely contained. They had their own agenda. Go ahead, Ben.
No, I mean, absolutely. You addressed it all right there. It's important to understand these different historical contexts to understand what we're living through today. We can't understand what's happening now without looking back at the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And even before that, it's important to stress this point, but just to do it one more time, throughout the Cold War, the U.S. policy was allying with far-right or right-wing forces throughout the world, and the Middle East is no exception. And in different parts of the world, these right-wing movements take different manifestations. In Latin America, it was the form of, you know, far-right dictatorships, Pinochet in Chile, the juntas in Argentina and elsewhere, and in Brazil, where you have a fascistic government. Well, in the Middle East, you have a similar situation, but you add the element of religion. And, you know, many of the governments, the regimes in Latin America, maybe they did have a Christian tilt. And maybe in different parts of, Southeast Asia and elsewhere. But in the Middle East, Islamism was a useful tool of right-wing politics to help contain many of these left-wing movements, which, as both of you just acknowledged, were largely secular in orientation, or at least religiously pluralist. They were led by, you know, ethnic and religious minorities. So Islamism was a great way, just as it is in parts of the U.S. with evangelical Christianity, to contain progressive forces and to disguise very reactionary politics under a kind of spiritual framework. So Saudi Arabia is really the beacon of this. And you were talking about Saudi Arabia earlier, and I mean, I agree to an extent, but I think you said that Saudi Arabia isn't necessarily a puppet of the U.S., and I think in some ways that's true, but also it's important to understand that while it might not be a puppet per se, the only reason Saudi Arabia has continued to exist as a regime with the monarchy in power is because of imperial support, because the British Empire before and then the U.S. Empire after World War II has continued to support the ruling family. Of course, because Saudi Arabia has the second largest oil reserves in the world and is the largest exporter, but also because since then, Saudi Arabia has been an important ideological partner in supporting many of these far-right forces against pan-Arabism and against communism. And we see this, of course, in Afghanistan. It wasn't just the CIA supporting the Mujahideen. And in fact, in a very eerie echo of the war in Syria, it was Saudi money that was helping to fund the CIA program, which is exactly what happened in Syria. It was Saudi money helping fund, in fact, like dollar per dollar, the CIA program training rebels in Syria to overthrow the government there. So Saudi Arabia has really been a linchpin ideologically and politically for many of these issues. And you can go back and read many of these declassified documents. You have even President Eisenhower, as early as Eisenhower, president saying that we should, quote, stress the holy war aspect in the Middle East. And you can read these White House meetings where they say we have to undermine communism and pan-Arabism. And the best way to do that is to use the banner of Islamism and to unite people with Saudi Arabia as the spiritual and political leader, being the homeland of Mecca and Medina. So these are all rooted in deep historical problems. But in the past 30 years, they have really manifested themselves because there has been a total obliteration of any kind of resistance movements against them.
Yeah, Ben Norton is absolutely right. I really agree with you, Ben. The Saudis and the Israelis are an extension of American power. I don't believe either of them are complete puppets of American power, but the United States realizes that they are indispensable. The U.S. used to see Iran that way until the Iranian Revolution toppled the Shah. There was
an island of calm in a sea of turmoil, yeah, Jimmy Carter said.
Yeah, exactly. And the Nixon doctrine, so-called, was Israel and Iran and the United States, sort of Iran and the Israelis policing the Middle East for, you know, basically U.S. imperial interests. Iran was gone by 79. The Saudi role became even more important. Ronald Reagan went on record in the early 1980s saying there won't be a revolution in Saudi Arabia, as if the American president could determine whether a monarchy should stay in power in Saudi Arabia. But Ben's right. It's an extension of American power, but they, at the same time, both Israel and Saudi Arabia pursue their own agendas within this larger sort of umbrella of, I don't know, what do you call that? Blank checkism. In other words, they have a blank check. The United States is not going to reprimand or stop them. And in fact, they are considered to be crucially important for the United States. The United States couldn't go directly into Syria, for instance, but it could set up through the CIA coordinating zones in Amman where the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks could funnel a lot of the weapons and money into these same entities. I mean, this is the cabal.
And this is nothing new. You remember during Iran-Contra, of course, it was illegal to sell weapons to the Iranians, but it wasn't illegal to sell weapons to the Saudis. So what we did is we sold these weapons to a Saudi arms dealer named Adnan Khashoggi, right? Or the American version is Adnan Khashoggi.
That's the way I say it.
Right. And we asked him to send the weapons to Iran. The Iranians paid for it, and then we asked Khashoggi to then transfer the money to the Nicaraguan Contras. Totally, completely illegal, but that's what the Saudis do, and that's what they did back then, and they've been doing it since the establishment of our so-called special relationship with them in the 1930s.
Yeah, Ben Norton, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. Let's go back, if we could, to the issue of immigration, because this is really dastardly on the part of Trump. I mean, trying to end the diversity visa program. In each and every instance, here we have a case of one man in someone from Uzbekistan, the former Soviet Republic in South Asia, carries out this attack, this awful attack. And now we're going to change the visa program such that people, again, especially from Muslim countries, are going to be denied entrance into the United States. The level of demonization in the United States, Ben Norton. I mean, it's of a criminal proportion, I think. And I even heard some earlier morning radio shows where people were calling in, like people who were Trump supporters, saying, this proves the president is right about the Muslim ban. I mean, it's just, it's out of control. Go ahead.
No, it really is. And it just shows how duplicitous and just dishonest a lot of this these politics are, these far-right scapegoating politics. It's not about facts. It's not about being rooted in reality. It's about using particular political instances to justify whatever means you wanted to justify. And actually, I think it's in some ways kind of similar to the phenomenon of disaster capitalism, which Naomi Klein, you know, wrote a book about. And in disaster capitalism, the idea is when you have these horrific incidents, you know, like a natural disaster or hurricane, et cetera, governments and corporate forces use that to justify imposing very harsh neoliberal capitalist reforms, privatization, et cetera. Well, I think we can take that idea and kind of juxtapose it or transfer it to the idea of the terrorist attack being a kind of exploitative scenario where politicians like Trump can use something that is totally unrelated to what he wants to accomplish, and just by virtue of trying to link it, use it to justify those policies. It's the same thing that the Bush administration did with 9/11 in Iraq. You know, as you said, Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11 attacks. But of course, even though there were no facts linking them, just by the sheer repetition of a lie and of you know, implications and suggestions again and again and again, they were able to justify invading a foreign country. So, of course, this has nothing to do with the policies that Trump actually wants to implement. A Muslim ban would never stop an attack like this. He's been in the U.S. since 2010. You know, most of these attacks are carried out by native-born people. But it's used to justify the policy simply because people are in a state of paranoia and fear. And that is a very dangerous phenomenon that I think we need to talk more about and combat, because it's what let George Bush take away many of our civil liberties, to pass the Patriot Act and to create a massive surveillance state. And every time there's another attack, you know, these far-right politicians are going to continue to exploit them for political gain. So we need to talk a lot more about this kind of disaster-oriented politics and say that, look, this is a horrific incident, but we also need to have, you know, a kind of a cool, laid-back understanding of what's happening. And we can't be so frantic and paranoid, because that fear is very easy to exploit for many of these far-right actors.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ben Norton. And also, it's really astonishing right now that we have politicians like Schumer, leader of the Democrats, and many Democrats who are now saying, Trump is bad. We need a good leader like George W. Bush. In other words, absent this kind of perspective and absent this kind of consciousness, people will just be pulled in this direction or that direction by opportunist politicians for their own good. And what we really need is a conscious movement where people are aware, people have perspective. Anyway, we'd like to keep going on this. We're out of time. We've been talking to Ben Norton. He is a journalist at Alternet's Gray Zone Project. You can find his writings at bennorton.com. Earlier, we were joined by Cindy Sheehan and Danny Shaw. You're with Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. After a short break, we'll be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.